when I moved to Canada, I didn't really make a conscious decision of like, I'm going to make protest music, because I feel like it doesn't matter what I say. Like, I can write an album about flowers and it would be deemed the revolutionary flower. You know, it just comes with the territory of not being white.
Okay, so welcome back to another episode of the infamous Black Tea podcast, co-hosted by myself, Dalton Higgins, and the lovely and talented Milena Williams. Mel, how's it going?
Great. I'm so excited about this interview.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we both feel blessed and honored to have this great artiste on our show today. We have Lito Pimienta. Lito Pimienta. Can we get some applause? Applause.
That's right. For myself.
That's right, exactly. And we're clapping for you, and we'll add in some sound effects. So anyways, Lito Pimienta is a Colombian-Canadian singer-songwriter who is of Black and Indigenous descent. Now, Lito won the Polaris Music Prize in 2017 and the $50,000 check that came along with it for her breakthrough album, La Papesa. Now, a little earlier this year, she released Miss Colombia, an album which she describes as a cynical love letter to Colombia, and the album features a swirling mix of Colombian cumbia sounds, electronics, and lush orchestration. Now, it's also an album that we at Black Tea strongly implore our listeners to go stream and listen to right after you listen to this interview, of course. Now, the catalyst for the album titled Miss Colombia came from when comedian Steve Harvey mistakenly announced that the crown of the 2015 Miss Universe pageant would go to Miss Colombia instead of Miss Philippines. And then social media went crazy, and the racist comments that followed towards Steve Harvey, Miss Philippines, was just completely unbelievable. But anyways, we're going to get into a little bit of that. But in addition to working as a musician, if I were to describe Lito as just a musician, I would be doing her a disservice. Lito is also a visual artist and a curator, and her work has been described as exploring the politics of gender, race, motherhood, identity. And Lito is also the mother of these two adorable kids who you'll sometimes see pop up on her Instagram feed. So how's it going, Lito? How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good, you know, like just doing, creating, thinking, analyzing, and starting all over again every single day, you know, just saddened but excited, hopeful but depressed. You know, all the feelings that Miss Rona is forcing us to face head on. But yeah, that's pretty much what's going on with me.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was watching a documentary yesterday, and they talked about this idea of, it's kind of like it feels sometimes utopian and dystopian and everything in between. It's just weird. But anyways, before we get into it, can we take a trip to Colombia first before we get into all things Lito? Are you cool with that?
Sure.
Okay, so here's the thing. Despite me growing up in quote-unquote multicultural Toronto and attending the school called Oakwood Collegiate, it was super diverse. You know, we had kids from, you know, across different, you know, parts of the world. We had never really learned anything about Black communities existing outside of Africa or the Caribbean, all right? So I honestly didn't really know that there were large Black communities in countries like Colombia, because the country is just never presented that way in the travel brochures. So when I went to Cartagena for the first time in 2010 for some work assignments, I was shocked and amazed to see so many Black people. I got to be honest with you, right? And then I was introduced to this community called San Basilio de Palenque, which is near Cartagena. And it was, you know, I learned it was comprised of descendants of the first free Black people in the Americas and all of this great, rich history. Now, can you sort of talk to us a little bit about the Black presence in Colombia as you see it, and maybe how these anti-Black racism movement is playing out, you know, you see it playing out here in North America? What's going on in Colombia? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the main thing that we need to understand about Colombia is that we're located in a place that is very blessed because of all of the different countries and access through ocean. So we have an influx of tourism constantly. You know, we have beautiful beaches. We're the number two country in the world with the most diversity or biodiversity. Mm-hmm. So the way that I see Blackness is in Colombia is, like you say, like you don't really see it in the media. And that's exactly what it is. Like, for Colombians, we don't see ourselves in the media unless we're the comic relief. the few like black like hosts and presenters, you know, they look like supermodels. Like that's pretty much it. Like you're either like a supermodel that like will click all the little clicks for them to accept you via, you know, mainstream beauty and a quota that they have to fill. They're still, you know, like 2% in mm-hmm. the media in Colombia, you know, like the billboards and everything is catered to Colombians, descendants of Spaniards, pretty much, you know. Even though we are, strangely enough, like everyone is very proud of our mixed heritage. And we're also very proud of like our dances and like dancing and music is so prevalent. All of the diasporic richness that we have in the country, it's very prevalent. And that's what people listen to the most. It's not like people are only listening to, you know, music from Spain. Like that's not what it is. We don't really have any ties to Spain other than like genetic, you know. And we're very mixed too, you know. But there is definitely a segregation. There's definitely an erasure of indigenous and black people, not only in the media, but also politically. I'm from the North Coast, which is mainly black. I'm from Barranquilla, which is, you know, like an hour, it's like a 40-minute drive from Barranquilla to Cartagena. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you grow up in the North Coast, you know, you see black people every day, you know, and your relatives are black and everyone around you is black and brown and mixed and, you know, with some kind of blackness. But you will see more black people in the poorest parts of the city. So in my family, it was different because my father, my uncles, you know, they're all like judges and lawyers and stuff like that on like my father's side. And on my mom's side were indigenous from the Guajira Peninsula. So for me, you know, like in my family, I saw everything. You know, I have relatives that don't speak Spanish. They only speak our native language and they live in the desert and they don't have a toilet, you know, and they don't have running water. But I also have relatives that, you know, live in like a, you know, big house and like they have like, you know, all the access to all the things, but still live in the provinces or cities that are in the North Coast. So that are considered, you know, not worthy of having access or like having electricity every day or having water every day, even though in the North Coast, we are the suppliers of 70% of the resources that go to the rest of the country. So it's very complicated. And you would not know because like the media is owned by these huge corporations that are owned by, you know, descendants of Spaniards, you know, mm-hmm. that won't accept any brown, black or indigenous person in their family. You know, it's like that colonial wealth because, you know, it's so interesting to me. Like in Colombia, we learn so much about slavery in the USA. We know so much about, you know, descendants of slaves in North America, but we don't know much about, you know, the survivals and descendants and children of slavery in South America, in the south of the Americas and Central America. You know, the only one that we know the most in the North Coast is Bencos Biojo, which is the man who freed the slaves in Cartagena and San Basilio de Palenque, which were port cities. So like the Spanish crown, they were just like, oh, okay, we can't really keep up with all these N words up in here. You know what I mean? Like, let's just take your little piece of land, you know, so they got their freedom. So very much so like Central Park in the States, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you can have this piece of land, whatever, you do whatever you want, you know, and then the community started thriving. They had their own, you know, economic, you know, routes, like financial stability, schools, and then the government were like, what? You are thriving without us? We want a piece of that cake. So now we're going to exterminate your community. And that's what happened in San Basilio de Palenque. So like the regression of colonialism that happens and like just, you know, it's just the insidious behaviors of colonization. You know, it's not just in Colombia, it's all through the Americas, you know, mm-hmm. and like there's countries like Mexico, you know, and where people are like they can't believe that there's black people there too. Like in Peru, there's black people. Yes, there's black people there, you know, and we're all descendants of that mix. But because we are not represented in the media, period, you know, and like, of course, like going back to my album, like, I just find it so interesting that the outcome after Steve Harvey made that infamous, you know, mistake, I thought that Columbia's, because we do have like a super harsh and very sharp sense of humor, that we were just gonna just laugh at the Miss Columbia. But instead, like, all of this horrible vitriol, because that's how we're raised there. You know, to this day, you'll hear comments like, "Eso es duro para el campesino," which is like, "Oh, this is very hard for a farmer to understand," and that's a comment. Or they'll say stuff like, "Oh, the Indian has arrived. We're gonna have to explain everything really slowly for you," you know, like stuff like that. Or like, you know, in like a regular respectable Colombian household, you know, you will hear your family or your mother or your father being like, "I don't want no black man in this house," you know. But of course, the girls will bring the black boy to the house. Woo! You know, it's like, we don't care. Like, the new generation is just kind of like, "Oh, really? Oh, okay."
It's so interesting. Sort of wanted to talk about your childhood and your background, because when I listen to your music, your authenticity is so clear and it's so evident that you're deeply connected to your art. So I just wanted to know, like, you know, how did your childhood inform your decision to even be an artist, and, you know, how it informs the intention behind your work now? Did you always know you'd be exploring such deep themes of protest, social justice, like a lot of the things you go into now?
Yeah, you know, I had a fair amount of freedom to do whatever the hell I wanted because I was a middle child. You know, like the middle child trope, it really applies to me. I was like this weirdo that was not girly, that, you know, my mom had to bribe me to put a dress on me. And I was always interested in art and music, you know, like my first show, I was 11 years old with people that are my age now. You know, I was very precocious in my interests.
So you weren't shy at all then?
No, I mean, I was very shy with my peers, like people that were my age. I mean, I was brutalized because I went to a private school, and only like people with money or influence go to those private schools. So I went to the school called the Lyndon B. Johnson School, where you were not allowed to speak English, Spanish. And then most kids in that school were like the sons and the daughters of, you know, the diplomats and stuff like that. But my school was like the worst of all those kinds of schools. So like, you're the son of the diplomat, but you're like the worst student ever. And you're like, you're a really bad student. So you end up in the kind of of the elite schools. And like, we ended up there because my mom didn't care. Like, my mom and my dad, they were just kind of like, our dream for our daughters is that they end up living in England. I don't know why my dad had that obsession. So for them, it was like the best way for them to get to England is to go to a bilingual school. And there's one around the block. So that's how we ended up there. And my mom worked extremely hard after my dad passed away so that we could continue in that school. But I feel like I learned more about life and English language just listening to the Spice Girls and listening to Radiohead than I did at school. And I also, there was this detachment because most of these kids, of course, are white Colombians, you know. So I'm there and like my mom will like show up to pick me up and she's wearing like the native attire, you know what I mean? Like, it was so, like, I loved it. I was always very proud. Unfortunately, I was never ashamed of where I was from. Like, it gave me so much pride, you know, and I was always very proud. But kids will look at me like, "Why is your mom wearing that?" And the food, even the food that I was bringing to school, it was all made in like fresh indigenous food. And like, all the kids were like having like hot dogs and French fries because they really wanted to, quote unquote, Americanize you, or like USA everything. So kids would just have like the Colombian version of McDonald's or whatever for school, but I would bring like, you know, my native food, you know. So that created this detachment from my peers where I was just this like strange person, you know, like, you know, I was not the one that was gonna get invited to the sleepovers with the other girls because I wasn't feminine. And also my hair, you know, just like my hair, you know, like I remember just being like reading a book, you know, which was like very, it was insane, you know, for kids in my school to read on their own. And I remember just hearing like clip, 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 and someone just cut my hair.
What?
And I just see it falling in the book, and I look up, and they're like, oh, hey, yeah, we're just going to put it in the microscope because we want to understand why your hair is that way. So, and you know, that memory, I keep talking about it, but when I remembered it after Miss Columbia debauchery. Like, after that, I was like, I can't believe Colombians are doing this. Colombia and Canada, like, I'm like, because, of course, I'm an immigrant, so I'm always comparing both countries, and I'm always like, Canada is trash. People here are trash. Mm-hmm. Colombia is perfect. And then that happened, and I was like, oh, wait, I feel like I'm being triggered right now. And that's what it was. And I was, oh, yeah, okay. So, you know, music became this escape, and art became this escape for me. You know, it was the thing that kept me alive in school because, you know, kids would make fun of me. They would make fun of my skin complexion, you know, like, you know, in Canada, I'm like, my family, they make fun of me. They're just like, girl, do you drink bleach for breakfast? Because there's no sun here. So, you know, I'm like really light when I'm here. So I go back home and I'm just like, take me to the beach so I can be of my original color. But kids would like, they're brutal, just brutal. You know, it's just like, would just make fun of me, my complexion, my hair, my body, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, they were just all jealous. You know, they did not have, you know, the body that I had, just blessed, you know. But to this day, I have like so many insecurities around my body because like I would get infantilized, but at the same time, you know, over sexualized. And so it's like it was very confusing. And then, you know, my mom she wasn't a single mom. She was a widow with three kids, trying to make it work, trying to get her kids through this expensive ass school. So we weren't having these conversations either. So I just had art to guide me. And luckily, you know, my dad, before he passed, you know, he left me his library full of encyclopedias and full of, you know, all these books and all that stuff. So I think that's why I was so attracted to art history and just history in general. And it really became the thing for me. And when I moved to Canada, I didn't really make a conscious decision of like, I'm going to make protest music because I feel like it doesn't matter what I say. Like, I can write an album about flowers and it would be deemed the revolutionary flower. You know, it just comes with the territory of not being white, you know, like if you're not, or hyper feminine, you know. So, and I feel like with Miss Columbia, I'm allowing myself to explore my femininity a little bit more, but it's very tongue in cheek. You know, it's just like, I am a quinceañera and I am also going to marry. And now my life is done. Because in Colombia, you know, when you're 24 and you don't have a boyfriend, wow, next year you're going to be 25 and you still don't have a boyfriend. Ooh, this is not going to, just not looking good. It's not looking good for you. And I remember growing up like that, you know. So, of course, I moved to Canada, meet the first ugly beep, 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 and I marry him, you know. You know, just like, oh, well, the Lord says I can't just have a boy, you know. And my mom never said that to me, but, you know, colonization and patriarchy, they have a way of being ingrained in your psyche, no matter how weird, experimental, artistic you are, you know. But it's never a conscious decision for me to say, like, today I'm going to write a song about the marches. No, I'm writing about my reality. Right. You know, I'm writing about how I grew up. I'm writing about the things that I see. I'm writing about my family. And then I'm noticing, you know, the differences between, you know, how, you know, a black young woman is perceived versus, you know, a white girl or whatever. And then, like, the nuances of, like, being light-skinned and being dark skin and like all of that stuff, you know, that actually you learn in North America, because we don't have those conversations in South America. It's just beginning, this conversation and those nuances. It's just beginning. Mm-hmm. Because in Colombia, it's like, you want to get a job, you need to put your picture on the resume. So that's what's up, you know.
Good.
So you were pretty outspoken about motherhood and being a mother in an industry that is, you know, it's an industry that's notoriously demanding of people's time and not always friendly towards women with children. And I just kind of want to know how you've navigated this space since you've had children and what lessons your children have taught you.
Like everything that I do, I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I figure it out as I go. So, you know, famously, I guess some people know, but whatever. I'll say it. I'll spill all the beans. So when I didn't have management, I had a fake email that I had for inquiries about people booking me and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, a big festival wanted to invite me. And I was like, you know what? I have to go kind of far and I have to be there for a week and I can't just leave my son. Okay, I'm just going to get my manager, wink, wink, to ask for all the things that I need and we'll see what happens. And I asked for, you know, flights for me, flights for a nanny, flights for this, my son, make sure that in the green room there it's clean, it's this and that, someone has to hang out with my son while I'm on stage, like all this stuff. And the festival wrote back and they were like, whoa, we've never had this kind of ask before, but let's see what we can do. And they delivered, you know. So for me it was just like, oh, and I just kept doing it, you know. It's just like I need to make this consensus, and when people book me, I hope that they made a conscious decision, that it wasn't just kind of like they just like drew my name out of like a mystery bag and then they're like, oh, we got this name, we'll see. Like, if you book me, you know that I'm about that life. I'm about that being a mom life. I'm about, you know, like, I'm not gonna bring a posse of people that are just gonna be there to take selfies in backstage or in the green room. I'm gonna bring up my crew that are gonna watch my kids while I'm on stage. And a lot of people ask me, you know, like, oh, like, you know, I'm in music and I want to have kids, but I don't feel like I should have kids because then my career is going to stop. And I'm just like, well, you have to make a decision, you know. If you want to have kids, you need energy, which usually means you should have them when you're young. Whether you decide to have a kid by yourself or with somebody, make sure that that partner is all about you being a star, you know. And like, when we know who the star is in the family, then everyone works towards the same goal. And that means taking care of the kids. And that means bringing the kids along and normalizing it. Just normalize it. It's just like, why should I not go on tour because I'm a mom? Why should I wait until my kids get a little older so that I can have a career in something that I'm passionate and really good at? So for me, it's just kind of like, I am here. I am an amazing performer. I am going to make you cry, laugh, be angry. It's going to be a beautiful experience. But for you to get the Little Pimienta experience, not only do you have to pay, you have to make it perfect for me and my family because I'm bringing the crew. And that's it. And if you can't provide that, then I'm not going. See you next year. But then if that never turns out right, because then that just means I'm just going to get more expensive.
You know, it's interesting, Lido, because when I was talking to my lovely co-host, Milena Williams, I was just saying, yeah, Lido, I've seen her around. I know her. She's really cool. But she's like a genuine artiste. And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes people tell me I'm a writer. You know, I do theater. I do drama. You know, I work in the film industry. But they kind of doing it like part time. You know, it's kind of like, okay, I do it on weekends and whatever. But, you are a living, breathing embodiment of an artist. Like, you're always creating, you know, whether, you know, visual art, you know, your music. Now, I noticed, you know, during this COVID period, this pandemic's been pretty weird and unusual and bizarre and stressful and just plain flat out weird. But, you know, you're also doing, you know, when it comes to your visual art, I noticed that you launched a COVID relief fund for vulnerable families that are experiencing food insecurity in Colombia, like where people donate money and then they get an original portrait done by you, right? Visual art. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? That's an interesting fundraising scheme that I think is going to work really well.
Well, it is. Actually, it is working because this is phase 2. And back in April, I started phase one thinking this is going to be like 3 months. If I can, you know, I need about $2,000 to feed around 60 families a month. I just made my little calculation and then I wanted to raise $6,000 and it took like 3 months to raise $6,000. So then this time around, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it again, but I need to offer something unique so that hopefully more people donate, because right now the country is in disarray more than before. And then I said, I was just like, donate portraits for donations. And then in like a day, I raised $7,000 or something like that. So my goal is 20K, because the Miss Rona does not seem to want to leave. And if she doesn't want to leave Canada, she's not going to leave Colombia. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's exactly what I do. You know, people, I get them to donate more than $35 and then they send me the proof, they send me a photo, and then they get a beautiful creation, which, you know, it's quite an honor to be painted by Lido Pimienta. They should be, people should just like the base donation should be $500, you know, but of course I'm not going to do that. But yeah, yeah, it's great. And I'm trying to get as many. It's a lot of drawings that I have to do. So whenever I have a break, I draw and I send. And hopefully we get to our goal. And then I'll take a break and then I'll start again. And I hope that every time I just like up the ante a little bit, because there's a lot of people that need a lot of help. And the feeling of impotency, it's very hard. Like when you're Colombian, like the frustration and inability to do something about our corrupted system, it can break you, you know? So I just use my little pen and my little colors and, you know, do the thing and just participate in my country, even though I'm miles and miles away. Yeah.
Alito, we really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to our tea segment. We recently found out that NeNe Leakes is going to be leaving The Real Housewives of Atlanta. Dalton, do you watch Real Housewives of Atlanta?
Yeah, it's a dirty little secret of mine, but it's, yeah, it used to be one of my like addictions, you know. I used to watch it religiously.
Yeah, it's so addictive. And she's such an OG. And I feel like even when I don't agree with NeNe, she's like the definition of wrong and strong.
Yeah. She's the perfect blend of like, you know, classy and trashy, right?
Yeah. So I guess she posted on her YouTube channel and said she had a very exhausting, long and emotional negotiation with Bravo, and said she wouldn't be returning for season 13. But a lot of people think that she may still be leaving the door open because she's left the show before. I personally don't really think she's going to come back because I just think she's kind of worn out. Not her welcome on the show, because it really is her show, but I just found that a lot of her storylines recently have been a little bit tiring.
Yeah, I would say. Totally tired. Like, yeah,
she's not the same NeNe.
No, she's like a greatly diminished NeNe Leakes. I mean, but you know what? But she had a good run. Like she's been, you know, she took a couple seasons off, but the show's been running, what, like 13 seasons? It's been going on forever.
Yeah, it's amazing. And she's like the only, I guess, the only original cast member who's still on the show, because Sheree, she had come back and then she left. Kim, I guess, came back for one season a few seasons ago, but this is it for the originals.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think she left? What do you think's the real reason she left?
I think that she was kind of forming alliances on the show for a while, and then she just started making enemies with a lot of people, and it became harder for her to cement those relationships and still be, because a lot of the things that she was mad about, like, I mean, NeNe's always mad about ridiculous things on the show, but like, I just found that, like, ever since she got mad that Cynthia invited Kenya to her baby shower, I was like, okay, I don't really understand what's wrong with her. Like, does she really hate Kenya that much? Like, she, I think she,
yes,
just ran out of...
Yes. Yeah, she did. Totally, yeah, yeah. I think it comes down to money. I think she wanted more money, you know? Because if we know...
Yeah,
there's one thing we know about NeNe Leakes. I mean, you know, you know, if you know Neelix, like we all do, you know, it's like, she's like Marlo, you know what I mean? It's all about the money. Don't fool yourself. So I think she knows that she's like a larger than life figure on the show, you know, versus the other cast members, they're doing their thing, but she's like the main draw and has been from the jump. You know what I mean? So she just needed a way bigger contract. That's what I think.
Yeah, but they always said that she was getting paid the most. I guess maybe she wanted more.
She wanted a lot more, you know, let's look at it this way. I mean, if there's no Nene Leakes, right? Like, as far as when they go back and forth, like, who's going to really bring the drama? Like, where's the feuding going to happen? Like, you know, it's just not going to be the same show.
I think we should take a look back at some of her iconic fights.
Yeah. Greatest hits and misses.
Yeah. So first is this one, I think it was season 2 or 3. Do you remember when she got into a fight with Sheree in the cafe?
Yeah, I was going to say, what time she got into fight with Sheree? She can fight with everybody, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, in the cafe, yeah, that was a classic. Oh, run that.
Juan, I don't need to take money from anybody. I am very rich. Get your motherfucking teeth fixed. How about that?
They're done.
I knew you had the rotten teeth.
If I don't go, you're going to be picking Sheree up off the floor, rushing that emergency room. So I need to exit to the left.
Yeah, Sheree always had such a funny relationship.
Sheree was actually one of my favorite cast members.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. I don't even know why. Don't ask me why. but in that clip, it was like they were about to just, you know, take off the earrings and get slapped upside Sheree's head. That's what that sounded like, you know?
Ridiculous conference call with this guy named Tyrone and Nene's friend. It was like some dispute over some sort of contract. And it was just, I don't know, Nene is just so funny. And this was, I guess, when she was doing do you remember her on The Apprentice? How she bullied Star Jones and LaToya Jackson? Like, there's never, Nene, everywhere she goes, like, she does not have a problem telling people how she feels.
You know, it's interesting too, when she left the show, I was actually disappointed in her part. You know, like, there were no parting shots, you know, at cast members or the network, you know what I mean? It's so tame, you know, where she says, I'm leaving the show. I thought she was going to take a bunch of shots at a bunch of people, but, you know, because that's the Nene that we grew to love and appreciate, right? Yeah, it was so tame.
She's been saying things on social media for months, but maybe that's a part of her exit that she's not, who knows, maybe she will.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the things she said when she was leaving, which I thought was interesting, is I'm just so happy that I can say I was part of a genre that opened up doors for Black ensemble reality shows to step up and be a part of what we now love so much, reality TV. And she's right.
Yes,
I mean, I feel like who is before Nene in terms of like that big personality on TV? Like, she's the only person I can think of.
She is the only person. I mean, even with her leaving Real Housewives Atlanta, like she could easily like hold down her own, you know what I mean, like have her own show, a spinoff.
She had one spinoff, a wedding one with Greg when they got married for the second time, but it's just so bizarre that Kim Zolciak got a spinoff and she didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Kim was the pink elephant in the room, or the white elephant in the room, is that Kim was the only like white woman in the cast, and then she got her spinoff and she wasn't even that interesting. I don't get it.
And the show's still on.
Yikes, that's weird. There's no one could explain. That's bizarre. That's truly bizarre.
I mean, Kim and Nene were at each other's throats for basically the whole entire run of the show, which I like because I don't really like Kim. But there was one scene where they were on a tour bus because Kim was on tour with Candy performing that horrible song, Don't Be Tardy for the Party, and Nene was just, hold on, this is the clip. She is so explosive. I love Nene.
That's right. Yeah. And even with that, it's funny with her. It's just expletives and, you know, like, she gets great. You know what? She just got grimy, you know, like over the how many seasons she was a part of the show. Like, it's just she was a textbook definition of just grimy and just like, I don't know, you know, but not a bad grimy, you know, a very pleasurable grimy.
Yeah, she's always been entertaining. I mean, there were a couple instances, very few on the show, I think. Season 10, because they were getting together because they had some sort of rivalry with Kim. And also like some parts of season 5 and 6 where Nini and Kenya got along. And I just found that like their personalities are so strong. They should be friends. They just could never get it together.
Yeah. I mean, but you know what? It also felt like it was a bit staged, to be honest. Like, I think after, you know, season 7, 8, it just felt like, because it seemed like Nini was feuding with like pretty much every cast member. And it just, some of it just felt staged. I was just like, this makes no sense. Like her and Cynthia Bailey, like.
Yeah, that's what you have to do on the show.
Yeah, yeah. To make it interesting, right? Yeah, yeah. And Kenya, like even the Kenya thing, like what was that? Like that was just ongoing. It was just like chronic. It was just every.
So many. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was the charity event where Kenya threw a charity event for Nini and didn't tell her. It was just, there's just been so many. It's just funny because like these shows, I don't watch the other franchises. I mean, I watched the Real Housewives of Potomac. It's a newer one.
Yeah, I've watched that. I don't.
Yeah, you watch that one too?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Good, oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's. I don't mind that one. Yeah, I didn't mind that one at all. You know which one was really big? But you know which one was terrible though? Even the Real Housewives of Toronto. Like, what did you ever get to check?
Oh,
that one?
I never saw it. I just.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You and most Torontonians never saw it. That's why it's not on the air. You know, I think I did one season. It was terrible. It was, and there was not one black woman in the cast. It was just whatever. It was terrible.
Wow. Well, I don't know. Like, if you think about the premise of these shows, it's just women sitting around talking, arguing, going on vacation, then having a reunion and arguing again about what happened during the arguments. Like, they made this, and I just feel like Nini is just she made this genre enjoyable for people.
That's right. That is the plot line in a nutshell. You know, a bunch of, you know, wealthy women going at it at each other's throats and traveling and complaining about what, you know, that's what it, I mean, in a nutshell, right? And they had that, you know, 13 seasons of that. That's something to be, I guess, celebrated, you know what I mean? In a sense, in a weird sense, yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. We want to thank our amazing guest, Lito Pimienta, and our awesome producer, Ryan Clark. You can reach us on social media at Milena Williams and at Dalton Higgins 5. And if you like us, leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.